Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 589 with my guest, Jen W. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. I'm a jackass that used to cook chicken on basic cable and tour around the country telling dick jokes. And speaking of touring around the country, we're doing a live recording of the podcast on Friday, May 20th in Minneapolis. I believe the showtime is 8 o'clock. I'll put a link to ticket information in the show notes for this episode, but you can also look up Sisyphus, and good luck spelling that, Sisyphus Brewery in Minneapolis, which is where the recording is going to take place. At one of my support groups last night, we have this, I don't know, what would you call it, tradition in this support group. It's a small group of friends who've known each other for a long time. And one of the things we'll do every other week is somebody can pick a theme for the shares. And somebody suggested talking about gratitude and perfectionism. And I'd never put the two of them together before in my brain until this friend suggested it. And I thought, wow, they really are connected, because when I'm in the mode of deathly afraid of making mistakes, feeling like, you know, some catastrophe is going to happen if I don't do this right, either somebody's going to not love me, or they're going to think less of me, or I'm going to fail and it will have been a waste of time, I'm completely out of the present moment because I'm so wrapped up in the future that I can't appreciate anything that's going on around me. And I think it's really, really hard to feel any kind of gratitude if our feet aren't rooted in the present moment. I cannot feel the good things in my life unless I'm in a place of relative stillness, and that mean voice in my head is at least temporarily quieting down. But I don't know. I wonder if you guys have ever made a connection between those two. And speaking of voice in the head, this is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Never Enough. And she writes to the question, what are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? These are so fucking spot on. You are an imposter. Your success is not deserved. No partner will want you if you cannot give them children. Everyone around you needs to feel loved and seen. You must make that happen. You do not give enough. Do not let them see you squirm. And you are the therapist. You need to be strong for everyone. And one more, why can't you just get it together? And you know, one of the reasons I love that, first of all, is I think all of those thoughts are so universal, so universal. But this to me is a great example of what human beings, therapists are. And I think it's what makes a great therapist, is that they know that battle in the head, that battle of the mean voice in our brain. And really trying to, as my therapist would say, you know, look at what are the facts on the ground as opposed to what the mean voice wired in my head tells me. This is an awfulsome moment. This was filled out by somebody who calls himself Frosted Pop-Tarts Are Better. Ha, Paul, now you have to say it. Well, first of all, fuck you. I cast you to hell. And not in just a speedy vehicle. I'm talking like a bullet train. Like where somebody actually gets on the rail and spreads, I'm not scientific, but spreads margarine. On that. Would that make it go faster? Because I'm vegan. I'm not vegan. God, speaking of rails, this has gone off the rail. Let's see, their awfulsome moment. When I was 12, I lived with my grandma. One day, I found her lying on the kitchen floor with blue lips. I did what anyone would do. I called 911. She ended up dying in the hospital about a week later. I got a thank you card in the mail a few weeks later from my aunt, her daughter, with $20 inside it. The card said, "Thanks for calling 911 for my mom. You did the right thing. Treat yourself to something nice." Like therapy. Oh my God. I love a good awfulsome moment. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Meat World. And about her love addiction, she writes, "I do not feel I have loved someone whole enough until I completely lose myself." And about her codependency, "I'm a house in flames. My world is on fire. No one but me is engulfed in the flames. I'm waiting for an extinguisher that never comes." And then she shares a snapshot from her life. On love addiction and codependency, "I do not just love," and love is in quotes, "I pour all of myself into someone until I am empty. I do this until I no longer recognize myself. I do it until my identity is stripped wholly and fully. I do not love, I deplete." Wow, that is so profound, and I like the fact that you called out the phrase love addiction. I wish there was another phrase for it, because it's not truly love. You know, it's coming from a place of emptiness and sickness, and it's a form of objectifying somebody else to fill our unmet needs that really we need to meet ourselves. And I know that sounds like a bunch of new agey horse shit, but I like to think of our relationship with ourselves as the meal and a relationship with somebody else as the dessert. And I think when we're in love addiction or codependency, we look to that person to be our meal, to fill them up, to fill ourselves up with them. But since I have started in support groups doing the stuff that I had no fucking idea was important to help fill the personal emptiness, you know, how I talk to myself, being aware of that, practicing self-care, getting enough sleep, taking a shower, brushing my teeth, flossing, setting boundaries with people, being picky about the people that I allow to get close to me, cultivating hobbies, working towards being an authentic person, whatever that means. I suppose I would say that's not liking it because you think somebody else is going to like you more for liking that. Liking it because you actually like it. It's crazy how many years we can be on this earth without even understanding what it is that we want or what it is that we like. It's crazy. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Gilda. She writes, "I understand that you were married for quite a few years, and yet you almost never mention that time in your life or anything about your marriage. Since you are so open about everything else, it seems, I'm wondering why that is." And that would be because my ex-wife is a very private person. And so I, you know, have always tried to be respectful of that, to be honest about who I am without kind of dragging somebody else's privacy into it. And I feel like that doesn't necessarily apply to parents. And I don't know, maybe that's unfair because I feel like parents are fair game. I don't know, that sounds cruel. But when I was doing the podcast and I was married, I did talk about my marriage a bit, not a ton, but a bit. This is also from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by an agender person who calls himself Rasputin. And they said, I've been plagued lately by the feeling that I am a fraudulent good person. I have plenty of people in my life who, when I express this, assure me that I'm doing my best and that's enough. But I can't shake the fear that I've tricked them somehow. There are some thoughts that I keep to myself, and I worry that if others knew these things, they would be horrified about associating with me. Do you feel this? How do you manage it? Is the answer to tell everyone everything? A resounding no. Everybody does not need to know everything. Unless you are struggling with, you know, obsessive thoughts, then talk to a therapist or, a support group where there's a shared struggle. But, you know, saying to the people at your book club, I keep picturing my, my next door neighbor having a knife sticking out of her head. You know, let me put it this way. I don't think everybody deserves to know everything that's going on in our head. I think it's okay to share anything that's going on in our head with people where it's appropriate. And then you would say, well, what's appropriate? And I would say, I don't know. You figure that out. You're on your own. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. I think most of us are pretty good friends with stress. We're quite familiar. We've been on vacation with stress. We've shared a cubicle with stress. And for me, therapy is one of the places that is my go-to for talking about all the bullshit that's rattling around in my head. And, you know, stress affects everything. It affects our appetites, how much we sleep, the quality of our sleep, our blood pressure. So if you're not in therapy, consider BetterHelp. It's online therapy. You don't have to leave your house. I'm a big fan of it. I love sucking my thumb in my recliner and talking about the battlefield that is my brain. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. And you guys, the listeners, get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part. That's betterhelp.com/mental. BETTERHELP.com/mental. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive. A must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath. And then finally, this is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this one is just so to the point. Lily says about her anxiety, it's like drowning above water.
Your fear of death is your love of life in reverse.
I'm a kinky person.
I didn't want to be...
I'm ashamed.
A sexual being.
Deeply ashamed.
You are...
I want to live...
Fucking depressed.
But how?
I can't do this anymore.
I will be uncomfortable so you will be comfortable.
Is life just a series of perpetual losses?
You're not depressed. We're black.
There is no real chance for intimacy.
We don't do that.
Without... risking being hurt.
Push it all down.
You can't go around it.
Ireland, like, we don't do mental health talk.
Through is the only path.
No one is ever alone. There's somebody else out there.
Don't forget.
Experiencing the same thing as you.
That the places you feel most broken now.
You just gotta look for them.
Will one day be your greatest strength.
And when you find them, it's a great feeling.
And I'm suddenly feeling horrible about making that joke, but that's how far I will go to get a laugh because I am empty inside.
Ah, you're in the right place.
I'm here with Jen W., who is a buddy of mine from one of my support groups. And we've been talking about getting together and doing this for, what, 900 years?
About a trillion.
Yeah.
We're that old.
There's a lot to your story that I want to get to. And it's funny because I know certain things about you, but there's also stuff that I don't know about you that I would like to know. I know bits and pieces about your childhood. The biggest thing that I know about you are your struggles with mental health. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure whatever the diagnosis was, but you would kind of go in and out of reality. And sometimes you would show up to our meeting mm-hmm. wearing a wig, calling yourself a different name. And my first thought was, is Jen pulling our leg? Or
I should totally do that sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was funny. I think
it might be morbidly funny. Show up and do that.
Well, we were fucking worried about you, man, because then you would disappear. And there were times that you showed up and you looked kind of disheveled and like maybe you were living on the street. I wasn't sure.
No, there were times when I was urban camping. I wrote an online book about it. It's called Dyslexic Haiku. So strange because I have like in the times when I'm sane, mm-hmm. When I'm taking my meds and everything's good and everything's on the up and up, I'm usually in school trying to get into nursing school. Now I'm in nursing school. Mm-hmm. So, but those times when I somehow managed to not take my meds because anybody who takes meds knows about side effects and size, how awful they can be. And for me, they drove me to homelessness. There was a time in my life I would have rather not take meds and been homeless and lived on the street. And, you know, I had money from the government coming in, so I wasn't completely destitute, but, there were some difficult times there. Yeah. So thanks for your worry and thanks for your prayers and blessings and everybody that saw me go through that time. I'm just so grateful that I'm still around and that I can tell the story. So
you must feel probably more than the average person feels when you drive under a viaduct and you see
myself
homeless.
I see
people
myself
there. What are the thoughts and feelings that go through your head when you do that?
I want to help. Part of me thought like maybe I'd do like mercy ships after I get through nursing school and I work for a bit and earn enough and invest enough. I was thinking maybe I'll do mercy ships and go work on a ship that's like a floating hospital and they bring surgeries to people on continents that don't have those resources. And then I thought I have a friend here in LA who wants to work with the homeless population. He's also a nurse, just graduated. And so I thought, well, why don't I don't know. What do I haven't, nothing set in stone, but I would like to help. Mm-hmm. I think on the times when I was off meds, before the pandemic, I remember like going on social media. My brother would follow me on social media and he'd send me pictures later and just be like, remember that when Jen? And but he would follow me on social media through my times in Malibu where I thought I was combating human trafficking and would be, you know, twittering to President Obama and thinking that that would make a difference. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, because after those times, like, I remember I would just blast, like, tons of, you know, well on people's, like, Twitters and stuff about, mm-hmm. you know, about ending human trafficking. That was, like, a huge thing for me for some reason. That just really, that was one of my really important, I think, messages for in this life at that time mm-hmm. was I... and it was interesting because after one of my episodes, I kind of came upon someone who had actually been trafficked, and she'd been coerced to come from Thailand to come to America, and I guess was stuck sewing in a house, and she was rescued and became an activist. Her name is Rachana Sussman, and she ended up marrying a professor at SC and. You know, she became an advocate for human rights and ending human trafficking. And so that was interesting because a lot of the things that have happened during those times of, like, out of touch with reality, but yet there's still some thread of, like,
yeah, I mean, noble cause fighting against human trafficking and
right.
tweeting to the president. Not that he'd ever see a, oh, hold on, Jen just... put me on blast.
Yeah. But like, you know, something happened. It was like after, you know, I was tweeting again about that. I was going through another, I think I've urban camped about two or three times. One for 8 months. One stint was for 8 months. Another time was for 3 months. So maybe there's two times. It's hard to remember exactly. Like my memory is kind of foggy about just because all the meds I've been on and just in general, I still take a lot of meds now and I take a lot of vitamins to kind of mitigate the side effects of meds. But
What is the diagnosis, by the way?
Oh, okay. So officially I was diagnosed at 21 in Thailand as bipolar. And then I guess progressed into schizoaffective, which is like a fun combination of bipolar and schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So you have the highs and the moods, highs and lows, and then the delusions and hallucinations, but not, I didn't.
And paranoia? Really,
Do you get
the paranoia?
Oh, yeah.
Because I have a friend sure. who has schizoaffective.
Yeah. And, yeah.
When he is slipping into a funk with it, and he continues to take his meds, but he said sometimes a feeling of such deep dread and paranoia will come over him, and intellectually he understands that he isn't about to die, but his body and his mind, he's hearing voices. He said it's intense.
Yeah, I don't know that I do. It's like I don't hear voices necessarily, but it's thoughts. Mm-hmm. And
well, that might have been actually what he said. He might have said thoughts.
You hear
might
like
have said
you
thoughts.
Get these thoughts, right. these thoughts, like having a conversation with yourself in your mind. I think everybody has that. Like it's to some level or degree. Mm-hmm. Like when indecisiveness, you know, like, oh, I want the, you know, root beer. No, I'm going to get the Diet Coke instead, or I'm going to drink water. You know, it's kind of like that, but a little bit more intense it can be. There was sometimes...
So kind of confusion and difficulty making decisions is part of it?
Initially, before I was diagnosed, that was one of the hallmarks of my... I think when I was going... They say you go into depression before you go into mania. Mm-hmm. And so part of the depression was that I remember like just being at a store in Thailand at like a 7-Eleven and just not knowing which yogurt to buy. Like just being totally befuddled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I remember being in, I think a James Bond movie had come out, and I was in Thailand. I was a model then and had been modeling for about 4 years. And I was in Thailand and I was in a movie theater and I had a bell, and somehow I thought that bells, when a bell rang, it signified that it signified something spectacular. So I kept ringing this bell in this theater until they dragged me out of the theater and took me to a police station for to see if I was, on some kind of drugs. And they observed me for a few hours and realized that I wasn't on anything. They videotaped me and I asked me questions. And then they took me to, a psychiatric hospital. Nicest one in Bangkok. Beautiful and manicured lawns.
Oh, really?
I could see outside, but the room was there was one large room and there's about, 200 women in it. It was just cots. I don't know how they managed. I mean, I guess everybody was on sedatives, so it's that's how they managed everybody.
Right.
But I just remember walking in there, and I thought that I was working for the FBI and the CIA, and I just thought I had all these kind of paranoid delusions about, I was going to be the next woman president. It would always go to that,
Why does grandiosity always seem to be it when people break with reality?
True?
It's always the FBI and the CIA. I shouldn't say it's always.
It is,
but it seems so often it's the FBI
Maybe
or
there
CIA.
Is an alternate reality that's out there it's the Matrix.
Right.
Because if so many people have had these delusions, maybe that's just some other plane that they're tapping into that's just...
Mm-hmm. I think about that sometimes when I'm walking down the street and I'll find myself wanting to judge somebody who's sitting arguing with themselves or with somebody who isn't there. And I'll think, well, what if somebody really is there and this person just has an extra sense that I don't have? And,
psychics.
I'm the one that... and then I say, no, that's not true. And then I... yell at that person. No, I would never yell at
somebody who's yelling at, who's having a conversation with yourselves.
Yeah.
With themselves, you could say maybe I don't know, what would you say?
They're never getting along with the imaginary person.
Can't you two just get along?
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. If you ever encounter that or you do that, or I dare you. Tell me what happens. If you ever see me doing that,
yes.
Feel free to interrupt and be like, Jen, I just want you to get along with yourself.
Yes. I'm here to mediate. I'm the Switzerland viaducts.
There we go.
Did your parents emigrate here from Thailand?
Yes, my father did. My father was an excellent student in primary school when he was a kid and in Thailand. So he won a scholarship to a private school so he's been speaking English since he was 10. When he was 18, he got accepted to CSUN and came over here. I don't know how he afforded it because my Thai family didn't have a lot. I mean, I think my grandfather worked for the railroad and my grandmother took care of the children. So I don't know how that all worked out, but I guess he worked and went to school and it was the 80s, 70s, 80s. So he was fine. And then he met my mother. My mother was adopted, so I'm not sure. Her father was an alcoholic, and she had mental illness as well, but she hadn't been diagnosed at that point. Or maybe she had. She was diagnosed. I don't know exactly when she was diagnosed, but whether she was in college at that time, both her and my father were at CSUN, and my father cut his hand on something in chemistry lab, and she was the nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, met, and they were really, they were very, both my parents were very funny. They would tell me jokes about putting, saran wrap on the toilet. just for fun. For other, just to have
to block it so somebody would sit. Oh my god, you'd have to be pretty nearsighted to not notice there's saran wrap on the toilet. But
they were kind of funny like that. So my mother had an open marriage at the time, and so then she got pregnant with my brother and she married my father, and that was not a great match for them because they were I guess culturally. And my father, growing up with him, he was very abusive for physically, emotionally, psychologically. I don't know if something, I think we've talked a little bit about this before, but I don't know if something else, I don't want to say specifically what happened. I have no clear memories of anything happening, but I had also been in a multiple foster homes. So I don't know if there was some kind of sexual abuse at some early age that I had blocked or, you know, was too young to remember, which is often the case. I mean, yeah. If I was a foster child at 9 months old, so anything could have happened. I think it's pretty common that mm-hmm. children are abused in order to, you know, to comfort, you know, to comfort them. They're, you know, touched physically and sexually to try and get them to quiet. You know, I've heard, I took a child development class.
I had heard that, I don't know if it was like Japanese mothers would masturbate their sons the yeah. night before their big tests or something.
Really?
Whoa, yeah, okay. I mean, that's something that I heard. And okay. again, this podcast is hosted by a jackass that used to cook chicken on cable TV. He is not a therapist. So the things that I say that I heard, please take everything with a grain of salt.
Mm. Yeah, well, I heard, I think it's probably true if you've heard it, because I did hear it was in a psychology class in a developmental, early age developmental, you know, child development class, and the professor was saying how, you know, mothers would masturbate their children just to get them to calm down. Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right.
So.
And by the way, I wasn't, to the listeners, I was not saying all Japanese mothers do that. I can imagine the emails that I'm going to get, but.
I'll second that.
Yes.
Paul did not say that all Japanese mothers do not, you know, that all Japanese mothers do not masturbate their sons.
Yes. Should we print up t-shirts
yes.
with that just to get a jump on the argument? Talk about Thai culture.
Oh, wow.
I know that's okay. a hugely broad question.
No, okay.
But I'm always interested in the not only the dynamics of first generation people, but just the culture in general.
Mm-hmm. What do you want? What would you like? Where would you like me to start?
For instance, here are some of the things that I know about Thailand is that it's a, for the most part, a very warm, emotionally warm people, very kind, very welcoming. And there's also this dark side with the Golden Triangle and the production of opium and meth. Opium much less more nowadays, but there's an area called the Golden Triangle where it overlaps Thailand, Myanmar, and Laos. Yeah. And I believe Chiang Mai is within the Golden Triangle. That kind of came as news to me because all I had ever heard about Thailand was how nice
yeah.
the people are, how mm-hmm. chill it is, how mm-hmm. peaceful it is. I know there was a little bit of a kerfuffle with the military and the king.
The king and the military, yeah.
Yeah. But I suppose kerfuffle, more than historically what I'm interested in is just the vibe. Mm-hmm. Any snapshots of your experiences wow. in Thailand.
Okay. That would be from 20 years ago. Hey.
That was the last time you were there?
No, the last time I was there was in 2017 okay. for a birthday.
Is she still chewing on your sweater?
A snapshot of Thailand. Wow. Okay, so as a young woman, I was 18. I was 14 the first time I went to Thailand, I was 8. I was with family. Then 14 was just my brother and myself and my father. And we got to do some modeling. Someone saw my brother in a mall and was like, oh, hey, would you like to model? So they invited my brother and they said, invited me because it looked fun. And so we did a couple of magazine shoots. And then that was that. And then when I was 18, I was getting into partying and raves and drugs here in the States. And my family thought like, oh, let's send her to Thailand. That's what they do with the kids, you know, when mm-hmm. they're misbehaving. It's just send the kids to Thailand. They can see like the real world, you know? Mm-hmm. And I still was involved with, you know, dabbling in drugs here and there. And then I got into commercials and this was when I was 18 and I was doing a lot of just like commercial work and magazines and stuff like that. Like didn't do any swimsuits or anything like underwear or anything like that. There was, you know, back 20 years ago, it was really taboo to, if you appeared in a bathing suit in Thai culture, it would be like, that would be the end of like your, you know, legitimate career as a model or actor. And so,
but not for the average person just going to the beach.
No, because Falang, because white people or foreigners they get a different set of rules. Right. But like, if you're going to exist in Thai society, like you can't even wear shorts like 20 years ago. Yeah. Shorts in Thailand were like, no, even, I mean, at the beach, even people would wear like pants, you know?
And so you're not just talking about in the modeling world, you're talking about just in general 20 years ago.
Yeah. Like now I see like, I mean, if you wanted to be respected as a young woman in Thailand, you wouldn't, I mean, you could wear shorts if you're like a, you know, foreigner, but as a young Thai woman in Thai society, that wouldn't be acceptable. Now it is, which is great. Like it's amazing. But then like there's this whole other side to Thailand where they had the backpackers, you know, pre-COVID, there was, you know, Khao San Road where all the backpackers would travel through and it was a really fun time to be there, especially for me being 18, 19, 20, 21, you know, just taking cabs everywhere and not, you know, smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol and smoking pot and doing, you know.
And did you speak Thai language?
No, I didn't speak Thai fluently and I didn't grow up speaking Thai. So I learned a little bit while I was there, but not a whole lot. So then I went back. So after I was diagnosed and then had that stint in the hospital, which cost me like, I don't know, 300 baht, which is like $10 something. It was like something really like phenomenally like cheap that was like, I was in the hospital for a month.
Wow.
Yeah. And so this big room and just cots and like this little outdoor area, they fed us on these tin plates. And I remember the bathrooms exploded. Like, not exploded, but there was some plumbing issue.
Right.
So the toilets were full of shit. Just like the day before I was leaving, I was like, okay, great. So that was an experience to forget or remember. I don't know which both. I mean, it was just an experience in life. And so that's one snapshot.
Okay. And there's a lot in there. I had no idea about the thing with the shorts and all of
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Oh, Thai society is very strict. It's very, yeah. I think the people, the stuff that foreigners hear about is like the foreign, how foreign right. people are regarded.
They're, right.
It's like jackasses that are like
right.
loud and noisy and wear shorts and, mm-hmm. you know, and
They're tolerated
because
they keep the economy going. Yes. You know, that tends to be the case for us white people pretty much everywhere.
Right. I am half white too, so yeah.
So I would imagine it's a different also set of rules and circumstances for Thai men.
Oh. Yeah, okay. So monogamy is not really a thing there that I –
For men. Yeah.
I don't know for women because I don't, but I know that none of my friends that were like Lukung, they were half Thai. Mm-hmm. None of them would really date Thai males at all or Thai men because, they thought they cheated all the time, which I don't know if that goes across the board for most cultures. I don't know how to frame it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of like, yes, it exists. And now that the former king has passed and the prince who is like this very, who's no one really likes, he's had several wives and I think the last one ended up in jail.
That doesn't sound good. Yeah,
I don't know why she's still alive.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on, but it's none of my business and I'll stay out of it. Yeah.
So do you still have contact with your father?
Yeah. I mean, we're actually on very good terms now. He has had a bout with cancer, mm-hmm. and that's kind of really like reset him and his mind to just like, I think he's really supportive of me now, whereas before he wasn't. And I think,
he was unsupportive in what way? He was ashamed of your mental illness or your life choices or what?
That's interesting. I don't think he was ever ashamed of my mental illness. It was interesting. He worked. He later became a nurse after being an engineer for 20 years. And he became an RN. And he actually worked in a psychiatric facility. I think he still works in a psychiatric facility. So I know he has an interest in, and it matters to him. But I think, like, in the past, we used to fight and, you know, physically get – it would, you know, really, like, it would decompensate to, like, physical fights, you know. And there was one time in high school where I was going to go out with some friends, and he came home and – he like literally put his arm, his hands on my neck, like he was so angry with me, and like, and I was like, and it was so embarrassing and so like humiliating for my friends to see that. And I never really had a conversation about it with him, and I don't know if I would bring it up because I don't know what it would accomplish, but it might just maybe some healing. But there's a lot of stuff that we haven't talked about, and. And that's unfortunate, but we found new ground on different things, like nursing. Mm-hmm. We both have that in common now, and he's like so proud of me. So he just, he bought me a really nice car, and like sends me money, and asks me how I'm doing, and tells me he loves me, and it's like, wow, it's this whole new person that I think actually the cancer was good for him in a way. Mm-hmm. Because we just realized we don't have a lot of time left. And also, I had a change of heart with reading. I don't know. Are you familiar with Brian L. Weiss? Mm-mm. He's a Yale-educated medical doctor with a specialist in psychiatry. And he used to perform hypnosis on his patients in the 80s. And never nothing out of the ordinary ever happened until one time he told one of his patients that was under hypnosis to go to the original trauma or injury, and she went into a past life. And he really didn't know what to make of it until, like, after 4 years of, like, healing people doing past life regressions, he wrote a book about it because it was helping so many people. Mm. And he's been the foremost authority on, like, past life regressions now. And
really?
Yeah. So amazing. So phenomenal. And I thought, like, I was so moved by his work because as a person with bipolar disorder, schizoaffective and mental illness and homelessness, and, there was a time I put a bag over my head and walked into traffic. I'm like, if I'm supposed to be here, please, somebody let me know. And
really?
Yeah, just at, like, was it Tahunga and Riverside, that intersection?
Well, you picked a good intersection.
Oh, yeah.
That's a nice place if you're going to get hit. That's at the top of my list. There's a Gelson's right there if you need to pick up a few things while you wait for the ambulance.
Oh, my God. Yes, that happened. And then I just had the suicidal ideology for a long time off and on because I didn't really have any direction in my life. And thank God I got into nursing school because, like, it's been 10 years and it's been so good with getting me just having a focus and having a direction.
Has there been stigma associated with you having bouts of going in and out of reality? Mm-hmm. Because I imagine for some people, it could be an end to a career. If you go off your meds and you have an event and it.
Yeah, it was an end to my modeling and acting career in Asia.
Was there a specific event that caused that?
When I told Pepsi I wasn't going to get out of bed to go to their movie, to shoot their commercial. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were like...
You were depressed at the time?
I was...
Or you preferred Coke?
What's that?
Or you preferred Coke?
No, I was like, so-and-so, who was it at the time? I think Naomi Campbell had said she didn't get out of bed for less than $10,000. And I was like in a manic high and I was like, I'm not getting out of bed for less than $10,000. The meds make me gain weight. And that's kind of like, that's one thing where something affects your self-esteem, but I try to manage it. Like I went hiking and swimming today. But in nursing school, I also get now as a side effect of the medications, I get migraines daily. So I have to take medication to medicate that. And if I get a migraine, then it I can't do anything at all. I have to just sit and like and just decompress for 45 minutes or 30 minutes.
It is so easy to see how people could choose to be destitute rather than be on certain cocktails of meds.
Yeah. It does a lot to a person's self-esteem when your physiology changes and mm-hmm. you get pimply and you overweight or you can't stay awake.
Get lethargic.
Lethargic, yeah.
Feel numb.
Yeah. So it's challenging. It's definitely challenging.
From what I understand, antipsychotic meds are getting better in terms of side effects. They're not as bad as they used to be, but I know every person is different in terms of how they react to things.
Yeah.
Have you found that to be the case or
no? Well, I'll say that I don't have to take meds every day. I get a shot every 2 months, so that's great.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's like $2,000 that I don't pay now, but when I start, when I start nursing, like mm-hmm. That'll be fine though.
So you go to the corner of Riverside and Tahunga and you put a bag on your head and they shoot you up.
Oh man, no, not exactly. But no, I go to a very nice psychiatrist who has one of the nurses. She'll shoot me up and then I don't have to take meds for two months, which is good.
Fuck, I would do that if I didn't have to take meds every day. Well, like one of my least favorite things is counting out my meds for the month because I take four different things. And I know it's a drop in the bucket compared to what some people have to do, but it's a monthly reminder that I'm dependent on a pharmaceutical company. And I fucking hate that because I don't trust them. Yet I also
they aren't
know,
to be trusted.
And I also know these meds are saving my life.
I wish some bipolar people would make some bipolar medications so that we can support them.
Right.
like some good people and not just like evil money-making, machines.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have a lot of clout. I mean, these doctors and their, lobbyists?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a friend who's a doctor and he tells me just the shit that they dangle in front of doctors' faces, the vacations and this and that. And he said, if you have no soul, you could get so much from drug company lobbyists.
Well, I mean, yeah. Then, but the cool thing about nursing, and it's funny because I was talking to someone recently about it. It's like I recognize that meds save my life. And they allow me to have a quality of life that otherwise I wouldn't be able to sustain. I'm like, I always told myself if I made enough money, I would just lock myself in a padded house and like have a staff of people to help me go wean off these medications and like find the right, supplements that would work for me. Who knows? But I heard of a travel nurse was saying that he knew somebody who made like 500,000 one year in travel nursing. So I'm like, okay, I don't need to make that much, but a fraction of that would be nice. And maybe I can do something with that. And maybe I can find alternate ways to, but then I'm just like, I don't know. I can't really I've tried so many times to go off meds, but if there's some other maybe combination that might work better.
And just not knowing in itself is like a mental hurdle, a mental emotional hurdle, this feeling that there's some better resolution or
is there
cocktail out there that if I just tried harder, I could find it and my life would be better. One of my biggest fears is that there's a better life for me right there. I'm just too lazy to figure out what it is.
That's really hard on yourself, Paul.
Thank you.
That's not your fault.
I think a lot of people that take meds feel that way though. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that I don't like my life and I'm not grateful for it,
but
I think every person who takes meds, they're going to feel, well, maybe not all, but many of them, you do feel some side effects. Maybe it's a bit of numbness. I don't cry as easily as I would like to. There's times when I can feel like there's a wall there that won't allow me to purge a sadness that's inside me. And I have the feeling that's because of the meds. But I know that the meds also allow me to function, to get out of bed, to not be completely riddled with anxiety or depression. So I'm grateful, and yet I'm also just, I don't know what the word for it, but a feeling of something not being resolved. Yeah. It's almost like I wish that it was, there was more known about what's perfect for each individual person. But it's so much trial and error. And a lot of times you're just like, you know, I'm good enough.
Yeah, exactly. There's going back to Brian L. Weiss and like suicidal ideation, which I think a lot of people with mental health issues struggle with. It's just like, why am I here? What's the point? I don't remember signing a contract with anyone. I don't, you know, to come here. Like that's, you know, so going back to past life regressions, which is, I've been looking for a hypnotist who works in past life regressions. I have a friend who's a hypnotist, but he's not familiar with that stuff and he won't hypnotize me because we're friends, which is very professional and I should say good job, but maybe he can recommend me to someone. But the past life regression thing is interesting because I'm like, if we do have work in soul groups and we come into this life with, like, you know, making contracts with other souls to like learn from them and you know, repay debt and so on and so forth, like, then there's a reason I'm here, and I want to be here to experience that, and I want to get all the richness that I'm supposed to get while I'm here, and then take that into the next life for the next better life, you know. I didn't really believe in that stuff before, but now because I had so many experiences like in manic highs, either talking, feeling like I was talking with Jesus, like really believing it, meeting the devil, you know, thinking the world was run by aliens, and if you know people don't, I think the last time I was on a manic journey was around 2019, and I remember just twittering to a bunch of billionaires, just like, if they don't, you know, why not just like donate all your money and then like start this chain reaction of everybody donating all their money? Wouldn't that be great? And then you could get
block,
right? Then you can make it back so much faster. What a game that would be. See if you could actually like donate all your money and then see if you can make it back faster. People would probably just think they're crazy, but I truly believe that. And I thought the world was being run by aliens and that something really, 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 really bad was happening. And then COVID hit and I was like, see, I told you. But like, I don't know. I don't really have like premonitions of things like, they're kind of crazy and I don't know, but.
I'm terrified of the idea of reincarnation because when I imagine it, I never imagine it being a better life. I always imagine it, I'm going to be in Calcutta. I'm going to be begging, you know, or I should say that there's the real possibility of that. I just don't like, because I feel like despite the shit that happened to me as a kid and the fact that I battled mental illness, I feel like I've won the lottery in terms of finding recovery and meaning and purpose in my life. Mm-hmm. And I feel like any spin of the wheel after this has got to be a downward.
It gets better, Paul. Like, I got to give you one of these books. It's like, it's.
I'm so suspicious of that stuff, though. I don't know. It's so woo-woo.
I know that. Okay, so here, this is how I got on that, even like, and you mentioned the word woo-woo. Okay, so there's two physicians. They were talking. It's Dr. Mark Hyman, who's like into functional medicine, which incorporates different modalities like acupuncture and other things like that into their practice. And he and another physician, Cynthia Lee, were discussing their illnesses that had been mysterious. They were physicians and couldn't get diagnoses for their illnesses. And they were ill for years. Like Cynthia Lee was ill for like 5 years, couldn't get out of bed, like couldn't work. Her marriage was suffering, all these different things happened. And so by, you know, kind of like these woo-woo ideas, she was healed. Like, I don't want to, she wrote a book about it, Cynthia Lee, MD, and she incorporates now, like she writes some of her prescriptions are like, go take a walk in the grass without your shoes on and, and, you know, and spend some time in the sunshine. And those are like her prescriptions, mm-hmm. you know? So,
That stuff is not woo woo, to
right,
me.
But I totally believe it's on the brink of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so I was shocked because then Cynthia was telling the story about to Dr. Mark Hyman about, how they'd bought a house and her daughter kept waking, like could not sleep well there. She'd always wake up with nightmares. And so they had a friend, Cynthia Lee had a friend, whose wife was a psychic, I guess, or a psychic healer. And she just came in the house just to visit. And she was like, oh, there's this energy here. I can feel, and so they went, got some sage the house. And Cynthia went through the house and, you know, asking these spirits to leave. And she's like, should I be doing this even if I don't believe it? And the lady was like, yes, you know, you're the lady of the house. You should do this. And then once she did that, everything was gone. No more nightmares. And the lady who was the psychic could also have she had a vision of a man in a plaid shirt. And she described the previous owner like to a T. And she said, like, Cynthia told her that he hadn't wanted to sell the house, that it was just like he had to because for financial reasons. So that it was kind of malingering in the house. Mm. And so, so that hearing two medical doctors talk about that was like for me, because, mm-hmm. because in my brain, I'm like, only that stuff is like manic. Like I can't go down that road because it's too close to being manic, you know, and seeing signs and things like that.
Yeah. That's got kind of, a trip that a solution might be right next to some of the worst episodes in thinking of your life.
Yeah.
So looking back, do you see any silver linings to the mental struggles that you've been through?
Yes, definitely. Miracles have happened. I've got to meet some really incredible people that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to meet prior. Like there was one person, it's so embarrassing, but I stalked people because I think it's like early childhood, like stuff. I didn't mm-hmm. get my needs met early in life. And these were like the parents I never had, I guess.
Stalk them in what way?
Social media. And so when I met,
were they aware that you were stalking them?
I mean, like, I think it was just like, I was just fascinated and obsessed with them. Like I just, mm-hmm. And there was a part of my brain too, where I was that crazy person where I thought that we should get married. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, and I know that it's a symptom now, so I don't ever.
Were they aware that you were?
I think so. Because okay. when I met one person in person, I said, well, where do I know that name from? I said, oh, social media. And then his face fell and like my feet turned to ice. And I was like, of course, like that would be so awkward and weird. But, mm-hmm. but throughout that, I found that, that person got to know me a little bit through, I gave them a little bit of like my writing of my book and an art piece that I made. And they went and they unblocked me on social media and they and this is like someone who's really like has very well like established person and just that person had the self-reflection and to give me another chance and like mm-hmm. and of course I messed it up but I know that I'm capable of meeting these that miracles do happen that I can meet and become, you know, anything. Anything is possible. Like nothing is not possible.
Do you feel like you have a good sense of boundaries today now that you're medicated?
Medication helps, yes.
Do you find that the intimacy issues that we work on in our support group, you know, very often a lack of boundaries, either our own boundaries or respecting the boundaries of others, can be a something that we need to work on. Have you found that even though you're medicated, you're still working?
I'm always working on something. It's like I play whack-a-mole with addiction. I think mm-hmm. I actually bought that domain name, like whack-a-mole with addiction, because I was just like, it's always something.
It's always something.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always, I mean, if it's not one thing, it's another, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's just like learning to be like gentle with myself and not like, not beat myself up and not be hard on myself. I like will have conversations with myself and like, you know, record them and listen to them, and like I'll call myself like as if like I'm talking to my friend on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So like I've learned I know that I'm here to learn something. I really want to know like why this like the stalking behavior, why did I need to read, it was my self-esteem so low that I needed the like the validation from from outside, from somewhere where I thought was like, you know, high and mighty and godlike, and and I think so, you know, it's like it's self-loathing. I'm trying to like,
so there, self-loathing is like a black hole. It will just pull everything good in your life into it.
But you don't even, and the thing is, it's like, you don't even know, I didn't even know it was there for so long. It's just like, I was separated from my biological mother at like less than a month old for 9 months. And so, and then given back to my biological family after that, and then separated 2 or 3 years old. And then 4 or 5, and then 10, and then 12, and then 12 is when I moved in with my father.
Other than that, it was all good, right?
Yeah, peaches and cream. Smooth sailing.
That is so much separate. I mean, I'm a believer in attachment theory.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And holy shit. Is that a rad
reactive attachment disorder?
Yeah.
It's like, that's like the bottom, like that's the worst of the worst you can get is like reactive attachment disorder.
So do you find yourself being attracted to unavailable people?
Oh, totally. And yes. That's
your pattern of dating guys that are.
Yeah. That, emotionally unavailable. Yeah.
Treat you badly.
No, actually.
Just indifferent.
There was one person I almost married, and, took a long time to heal from, but you know, when I'm making conscious decisions about trying to find healthy relationships, I manage to find healthy people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And my therapist at the time thought so as well. You know, she thought that this person that was that I almost married was healthy, but I went off meds, and we were thinking, you know, his father was a physician, his sister was going to med school. Like we thought, oh, you know, if anything happens, we'll catch it. We didn't. And I broke the trust. I thought he, you know, I got paranoid. I thought he was sleeping with someone else. And like, so I, you know, he left me in the apartment by myself for like 10 days while he was, you know, flying around the country and meeting with different clients for work. And I just decompensated and, you know, I slept with someone. He found the evidence and that broke his heart. And it was interesting because it's been like, I don't know. It was 2009, so it's been a while. But my brother actually was living in the apartment building that my ex-fiance is now like. He thinks he's the president of the company. He's going to be the CEO soon. But he was just over there in Chicago a few weeks ago, and my brother ran into him, and it was interesting. I was like, I'm glad, you know. I tried to reach out to him several times later and apologize and make amends and stuff, but I guess, you know, he'd moved on, and I was just happy for him. I was like, I was happy, and it was kind of weird, but it was good to know that, because it always kind of compared. You know, I think when we were in our 20s, he was making like $380,000 a year when we were like 20 and 27, and we're looking at $2 million houses. And I remember, you know, buying this $50 t-shirt thinking like, if I can't buy a $50 t-shirt, will I be happy again? Like, will I still find happiness? And I'm like, yeah, I'm still happy. But now I'm at a place where I'm, you know, with nursing, I will be able to buy a $50 t-shirt again.
Right.
You know, and it doesn't change anything, but it's just, it's kind of like, it's my little like nudge from the world to let me know like you're in the right place at the right time, like you're doing everything right.
That to me is really the ultimate comfort, is when you not only think I'm where I'm supposed to be, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, but you feel it. And that often, to me is the lottery.
Yeah. And oftentimes have you come across those moments where you feel like you get that moment and you're the only person that recognizes it and knows that specific moment where you're just like, it's all come together and it's tied nicely in a bow. And it's like, wow, that was 10 years of work. And like, but you come, and It's an amazing feeling.
And I get it sometimes without any specific event or thing happening. It's just all of a sudden I'm soaking the universe in, and I can feel all the good vibes that are there for me, and that that my life isn't a series of fuck ups, that there is some guiding force in it, and that that I'm doing good.
You are doing good.
That I'm good. You know, not necessarily meaning that I'm doing good for the world, but that I'm playing the hand that I was dealt well. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Just how grateful I am to you for having curiosity to learn about me, and I appreciate that. Thank you for seeing me and taking the time.
Well, it is nice to see you healthy and functioning and thriving.
Oh, my God, yes. Round of applause.
Round of applause.
For both of us.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks, Jen.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been wanting to have her on for a long, long time, and it is such a relief when you have a friend who is kind of on the cusp of, I don't know what the phrase would be, losing it or, disintegrating, and to have them come back and thrive is just such a fucking great, it's such a relief, and it's also so exciting just to see what they're going to do, with their life.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, filled out by a guy who calls himself Overreacting Loser. He says about his depression, like walking through fog, being assured by others that the sun is coming up soon, only surprise there's only fog. Could I have fucked that up anymore? I don't think so. About his OCD, I must breathe to the rhythm of this song stuck in my head or it'll kill me, even though the hyperventilation will probably kill me anyway. Snapshot from his life. One of my sisters posted a picture of all of us on Facebook for Siblings Day. I was horrified, shamed, and embarrassed by the photo, while others thought it was damn funny. I wanted to ask not to be tagged in things, but who the hell am I to tell others how to use social media? And since my sisters were considerably more popular growing up, I'm assured that all the people I've been trying to hide from or lay low from are getting to see it. Great. Another exhibit in the case of me being a pathetic loser. You know, I have noticed that the surveys filled out by men, you hear the word loser pointed at themselves a lot more than women. Not that the women in the surveys have necessarily more positive attitude about things. It's just, there seems to be a classic way of phrasing whatever our struggle is, especially if it's internal. It, with women filling the surveys out, it tends to be a lot more about their looks, their weight. And guys, it tends to be more about what they're doing for a living and how much money they're making. Should I type that up and get that out to you so that you can nominate me for a Nobel Peace Prize for my observation? This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself the Black Knight. He identifies as straight. He's in his 20s. Says he was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. He's never been sexually abused. Although he writes sketchy stuff with similar aged relatives when we were really young, but I've processed the events on my own and don't interpret it as abuse or assault. It hasn't affected my life. He's not sure if he's been physically or emotionally abused. Deepest, darkest thoughts? That I may be a hopeless pervert, even though I don't have the evidence to back that up. And that even though I love my fiancé, I loved my girlfriend who committed suicide 6 years ago just as much too. And I've had very strong feelings for other women since then as well. And at the same time, I could probably marry 4 different women I care for right now. That is something I would never tell my fiancé. I'm honest, but no fool. Speaking of sharing everything in your head with everybody, yeah, that might be a good thing to share with the therapist or support group or a close friend, even if just to let some of the pressure, if you're struggling with those thoughts or feelings, because, you know, that old adage is true that takes the power out of things when we put it into words. Darkest secrets. I've never cheated on my fiance, i.e. no kissing or genitalia touching, but I have done almost everything else with a few other women. Cuddling, sharing a bed, dancing, massages, dates, and even being a dom engaged in public flogging action. I didn't break the rules, but it could have gone bad fast. Well, let me throw this out there as a thought. Should the line be of what we cross or what we don't cross? Shouldn't it be, would we do it if that person, if our partner was there? That's, I think, a good barometer of whether or not something is appropriate. Ooh, my stomach's chiming in. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. Orgies, 2 to 3 women deciding to pleasure me with a group foot job. Having sex for an audience. Bring just friends with a woman who wants me to watch her have sex. Maybe even my fiance magically having a penis for one night. I'm okay sharing all of those except the foot fetish one. When I was young, my mom told me my dad had a foot fetish. It grosses me out knowing that's one of our few connections. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I really liked you to every girl I didn't have the courage to ask out. I hated being a coward. What, if anything, do you wish for? I can complete my mission in life. It's going to happen anyway, though, so I may as well save that wish to ask for money. Not sure I understand that. Have you shared these things with others? Every now and then I will. Typically it goes well and they share their thoughts too. Thank you for filling that out. I appreciate that. You know, since I started doing this podcast in 2011, I've read probably 8,000 or 9,000 of these Shame and Secret surveys, and I've learned so much about not only the variety of people's sexuality, but how we internalize our thoughts and how we feel about it, and oftentimes how it's related to things from childhood or adolescence. Would you like me to type that up and send it to you so you can nominate me for a Nobel Peace Prize? This is from the Awfulsome Moments survey filled out by Mayberry, and she writes, my 2-year-old daughter was sick over Easter break while I was at my parents' house. I was really stressed and told my mom that I was having a hard time with motherhood. She looked at me and said, oh, I know how hard it is being a mom. You were terrible. Thank you, Mom. I feel so much better. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Roller Coasting. She identifies as straight. She's in her 50s, says that she was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. She writes, I've had some hazy memories come back in therapy. For a while, I was back and forth about whether my dad really did sexually abuse me, and in parentheses, touching. But so many things fell into place once I let myself believe it was true. I felt so much shame leave me, and I'm so much more comfortable around people. I don't want to run and hide from being close or even having someone look at me during a conversation. Also, lots of little weird things that didn't make sense. Make sense in the context of him abusing me sexually. Still, it's a struggle to not have clear memories. Yeah, that is a such a tough road when somebody's trying to process stuff. But, you know, what I like that you filled out was that you gave weight to it just to see what would happen. Because a lot of times, we won't even open that door. And for me, there was no healing until I said to myself, what if I'm not making too big of a deal of this? And that's like when all the feelings came forward. So it's good to hear that you did that. Not to, you know, punish the person that did it, but to stop punishing ourselves by minimizing it. She is not sure if she has been physically or emotionally abused. There were no feelings allowed in our house growing up, not even good ones. Everyone acted like it was really embarrassing if you were even happy or you were ever happy. Yeah, I would call that emotional, at the very least, emotional neglect. And that is a motherfucker, man. Or when you have a parent that can't stand seeing joy, boy, you want to talk about something that will bury anxiety in you for the rest of your life. A killjoy parent that, oh, it's the worst. Any positive experiences with abusers? Yes, for sure. We watched movies together constantly when I was growing up. We still do. I feel sorry for him, an emotionless old man who has no real connection to his children. It also fucking pisses me off that I feel sorry for him, because what the fuck else does he deserve? Darkest thoughts. Telling my sister-in-law in a very mean and blunt way that my dad sexually abused me. I would love to see that sympathetic look wiped off her face, and she would finally stop saying things like, I hope you find your happiness. Everyone is so sure I'm the problem, but I'm the only one being real. Darkest secrets. Because the memories of the sexual abuse are so new, I've gotten to the point of being ready to tell my siblings. It's a big weight and something I'm angry to have to bear. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. Before I let go of a bunch of shame via speaking about the sexual abuse, I fantasized about being an object, a thing for others' use. That has faded away, and I'm pretty vanilla now, although who doesn't like a spanking? Now that's a t-shirt right there. Who doesn't like a spanking? What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I want to tell my dad he hurt me. I'm afraid he'll laugh or ignore me. I want to share what happened with my siblings, but they probably will shut down and not respond or even look at me. I couldn't take that right now. And I would definitely talk to your therapist or a close friend about that, because it might be good to not, you know, reopen that wound by bringing it up with people that are just going to deny your reality, or at the very least be prepared for them to react in a way that is hurtful or disappointing. What, if anything, do you wish for? The courage to ask more questions about my childhood. I just recently had my dad tell me that they took in a girl to adopt, then, quote, gave her back. I think there's more secrets there. Have you shared these things with others? The few people I've told have been kind, but they don't know what to say. Man, I think a support group not only would be awesome for you, but I think you would be awesome for a support group. Because you seem like a curious, seeking, sensitive person. And those are the people that make support groups awesome. This is from the Awfulsome Moments survey, filled out by a guy who calls himself Scared Fat Child. He writes, I'd been strung along for months for a new possible job as a business support specialist, a job that made my art school grad stomach turn, but I needed the money. I'd already done 2 Zoom interviews, and yesterday I went in for my in-person 3rd and hopefully final interview. It was terrible. The office was in a very expensive, white, and sterile part of the city. The office was drab and soulless, and my potential boss was a vaguely racist elitist who I desperately wanted to be away from. I got home dejected and opened up an Amazon package. It was a dress shirt I bought for that job. I couldn't even button it. I was now too fat for an extra large shirt. I packed it up and started walking to a return drop-off location. As I started walking, I began to feel better. The sun was shining, and I was making peace with my situation. Ahead on the quiet neighborhood sidewalk stood a cute squirrel doing that little stance with her front paws curled into her chest. She was plump and had large nipples, so I assumed she was a new mom, probably out foraging for her spring babies. I wished I had something for her. I thought about how silly my problems were, how this cute squirrel was just living her little life without ever considering a job or feeling shame about her body. As I got closer, I made kissy sounds at her, which startled her, and she ran out and was killed by a car. Soon after, the sun disappeared and it began pouring rain, completely soaking me in my shorts and summer shirt. Oh my God. Oh my God. That's like out of a movie. And I almost didn't read that because I hate reading anything for myself or for you guys that has to do with animals being hurt. But that one was just too awfulsome to not read. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by Max. And, what are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? He writes, that's the reason I am single is because I am difficult. That the reason I am single is because I'm difficult to be with. I was super bullied as a child and grew up extremely hating myself, my body, and most things about myself. Very fun. I've done a lot of work to actually grow a lot in my self-image, but all of my childhood bullshit leaves me needing a lot of presence from people in my life. I have an amazing group of friends who have shown me what love looks like, but I cannot keep a romantic interest or partner in my life for longer than a month or two. I don't feel like asking to spend time together is a ridiculous ask, but for people in college, it seems to be. And when people in my life, but especially romantic interests, aren't able to give me anything near the amount of time and space that I'm able to give them, I get anxious that they're going to leave. I'm an anxious person and a worrier, and I'm honestly pretty accepting of myself in this, but I worry that these traits get in the way of making actual meaningful connections. Like, I can't imagine a world where being present in the people you care about's lives being a bad thing. But in college, it seems like the only thing anyone wants is that aloof, I don't give a fuck about anything attitude. I graduate in a little less than a year and have had 0 long relationships in college. And at that point, even though I know it's not true, when I lie alone with myself every night, my brain points it back to me. Oh, also, even though my friends tell me I've turned myself into a stereotypically attractive person, that the fact that I don't have a ton of matches on online dating sites means that all that work was for nothing and I'm still the ugly high schooler, but just without the extra weight and some more expensive clothes. As I was reading your, first of all, thank you for sharing that. And as I was reading your survey, you know, a lot of stuff popped into my brain. The first thing was, well, people in college, a lot of them are still fucking children, you know, they're 18 to 22 years old, not very emotionally mature, don't know what they want. So I wouldn't take the way they treat you as a reflection necessarily of who you are. But more than that, I was thinking, what if you tried some type of trauma therapy like EMDR or something else? Because it's possible that your anxiety is, you are just running around in survival mode still feeling like that kid that was bullied. And that stuff gets trapped in our cells. And there are modalities of therapy that can help release that, EMDR being one of them. So that might help, not only with your anxiety, but with, you know, how you relate to people and not feeling that sense of trepidation and like you're too much. Just a thought. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Catholic and suicidal, but only casually. That's a movie title right there. She is in her 20s, identifies as bisexual. She writes, I lean more towards feminine men or submissive masculine men. She says she was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts. I lost my virginity at 21 because every time I tried with boyfriends, the pain was excruciating. Figuring I'd go to the doctor if I couldn't figure it out, I decided to try one more time with my then boyfriend. We tried and the pain was too intense and I freaked out and said I wasn't ready. My boyfriend got impatient and frustrated and continued despite my extreme discomfort. Yeah, that's more than just possibly counts. That is sexual abuse. My boyfriend, I laid there and tried to check out. I don't remember much of it, but I remember briefly thinking I wanted to accept what was happening so I wouldn't be another statistic. Fucked up, I know. I think now, years later, that while maybe it's more of a gray area, it still wasn't okay. If you expressed to him that you wanted it to stop and he didn't stop, that's, to me, not a gray area. That's clearly a violation. She's never been physically abused, but she has been emotionally abused. I've recently accepted that my mother has been emotionally neglectful and at times abusive since I was 10. It's harder to explain as I just remember her being this way, so it seems normal. My alcoholic father has been an emotionally absent parent to me and abusive to my siblings. I've also had emotionally slash verbally abusive romantic partners. Any positive experiences with abusers? Absolutely. Despite my difficult relationships with my parents, I do love them, and they've done a lot to make sure we had a roof over our heads and food on the table. It's difficult to accept that I resent them for not being emotionally invested parents when they worked several jobs to make sure we were fed and saved money for our education. Well, you know, they're not mutually exclusive. Somebody can be emotionally present in the rare moments that they have time with you when they're working two jobs. Yeah, maybe that's a lot of expectation to put on a parent who's, you know, fucking exhausted and maybe wasn't raised with those tools. But I'm saying this so that you will stop minimizing what your needs were as a child and saying, I should just get over it. It's not that big of a deal. No, it's a fucking big deal when you don't feel emotionally connected to the people that you are supposed to feel safest with in your life. And that is regardless of what they're working, what they're doing. It is the quality of your time with them, not the quantity of your time that we're talking about. All right. Darkest thoughts. I am, quote, casually suicidal, unquote. I fantasize about how I would die in the way that will cause the least amount of pain to my family and friends. I take an absurd amount of relief in these thoughts. I don't plan to act on them, but it sometimes ironically helps me get out of one of my dark days. I think about running away to another country, disappearing in a big city or in a remote mountain range, and never talking to my family again. I think about going to a cold, snowy mountain on a hike and enjoying the silence and the hum of nature before slowly freezing to death. In the parentheses, this is related to a way I used to self-harm, but I work on it with my therapist and have not self-harmed in 4 years. Well, high five on that one. Darkest secrets. I'm bisexual, but I don't let anyone know. I'm Catholic, you know, about that classic Catholic shame and guilt. My mother would disown me. I've slept with women, but I'm afraid to even think about having a relationship with one because I will always choose my family over a partner, and it will hurt that partner. I have not shared my virginity story with anyone, not even my therapist. I'm not sure why, as I'm very open about sex and sex positivity, etc., but I can't bring myself to talk about it. Sometimes I think it's because it doesn't affect me much anymore, but maybe it is. I am hypersexual and have a lot of sexual kinks, but I've never felt comfortable talking about them to anyone in my life. I desperately want to, though, so I suppose I should try. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I would really like to be in a dom sub relationship with a man. Those are basically my only porn searches, and I am turned on by women dominating men, specifically when they do it without needing to act manipulative or dismissive. I guess I like the idea of being in control and needed without having to be abusive to get those things. You know, what I really love about this, first of all, that you're bearing your soul and you're sharing your truth. But I love that you are sharing something that you so rarely see in pornography, and that is subtlety. It makes such a big difference in so many people's turn-ons, the nuance of it, you know, the attitude of one person playing a role or a fantasy that we have. And it just, you know, I'm not currently looking at porn, but in the days when I was, it would be so frustrating trying to find something that was in my kink wheelhouse that was just so either overacted or it was some stereotypical cliche. And it made me want to get onto a job search site and apply to be a writer for a porn company. Continuing. I know there is a culture for this, well, the sexual part anyway, but I'm terrified to ask about it, as all my closest friends have said rude things about this lifestyle, and I wouldn't know where to start. Pretty common kink, but somehow scarier than coming out as bi or talking about my possible sexual assault. Sharing it now, I guess it's nice, since I don't think I can tell anyone else. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to tell my mother how much she's hurt me and how much she's affected my self-esteem. I would tell her to take a fucking mental health class so she can stop treating me like I'm being dramatic and making me feel worse. I would tell her that even when I'm hurt by her, I love her. I would tell her that when my depression anxiety cycle hits and I have to isolate myself from her to keep from harming myself, I still love her, appreciate how hardworking and independent and sometimes goofy she is, and accept her for who she is, even if she can't do the same for me. I would tell my father I love him, that I understand him better than he'll ever know, and that I wish he would just for once try and get help. What, if anything, do you wish for? To have a healthier relationship with my parents and siblings, to be able to be open about my sexuality, to be able to find a partner that I can trust and share my sexual preferences with. Those are all right-sized emotional needs. It's amazing how long we can go through life thinking our right-sized emotional needs are gigantic and imposing and asking too much. How do you feel after writing these things down? All right, I guess. In a way, I'm finally talking about some of these things. Yeah. And that's awesome, man. I appreciate it. I really appreciate when you guys go down into the crawl space and bring up the icky. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself never stood a chance, but still in the fight anyways, because I don't like being told what to do. And she writes, Quick backstory for clarity. My childhood played out in a house full of dysfunction. There was ongoing incestual abuse occurring in our family for 10 or more years. I finally disclosed the abuse when I was 12, and then all hell broke loose in our family and didn't begin to settle for many years. One moment that I personally find hilarious for the hypocrisy and makes me want to cry is when our parents would leave, they would leave me in charge as a babysitter, even though they'd been told by our therapists and child services that they were not allowed to do so. The last thing they would do before they left on a date or go to a church thing or whatever it was that specific day, they would say, "Make yourselves proud," which we all understood to mean, "Don't molest each other." Oh my God. And she was not the molester. I didn't read all of her her survey. Her brother was the one. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself, "I'm a scared media designer teacher." And she writes, "So as my name says, I'm a media design teacher and I have an anxiety disorder. I work at a school for children with autism, ADHD, and other learning or living struggles. So last week after the fire alarm went off, normally I would be scared and be in pure panic mode. But the moment I saw one of my students, the look in her eyes, my mindset changed. Suddenly, my anxiety was gone and I could only focus on getting my students out of the classroom without making them scared. I held the hand of the ones that needed it, and we walked safely to the area we needed to be in. I counted my students, and the building area was safe. After that, I felt so proud of myself. It felt like a step forward in my recovery." That's beautiful, and I'm sorry I stumbled over that. It's just, I think people fill these out on their phones sometimes, and the punctuation can be a little hard to read. And the translator, Siri, is a fucking horrible translator. So a lot of times I am substituting words on the fly as I'm reading these things. And I'm dumb and old. And that's really, more than anything, what I want you to get out of it. That Paul is dumb and old. Maybe I should change the name of the podcast to Dumb and Old. You know who I'd get to listen? A lot of dumb old people. Oh, I love dumb old people. Finally coming into my own. You know you're dumb and old when you start making things plural that aren't plural. I remember my dad saying, "You want a Heineken's?" I just remember thinking, please shoot me. Please shoot me the day Heineken's comes out of my mouth. Well, I hope you enjoyed the podcasts. I hope if you're out there and you're struggling that you know you're not alone and that there's help and there's support. Our people are out there. We just got to find them. And never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening. Heineken's.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.